Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet and you meet.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
You do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers.
Greg Gieson with us. He's the author of Mondays at 3, and it's a story for managers, managers learning to lead. He's the president of Greg Gieson Associates, management development company specializing in conflict resolution, leadership development, team building, and motivational speaking. He's an adjunct professor at the University of Denver. He's the author of 3 books on creating authenticity, including his latest, Monday at 3, again, a story for managers learning to lead. And Greg, hi, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael, I was just getting into the music. I love the song.
Oh, I know, it's great, isn't it? Greg, when we talk about management, define management. You know, there's so many people who say I'm a manager or companies managed well, and they usually have no idea what the definition of management is. So let's start at the beginning and say, this is management, and then we'll work our way from there.
You know, that's a great interview question, too, by the way. You know, I guess I think there's a difference between managing and leading, and you've probably heard that scenario divided up before, but
sure.
Managing, obviously, you're in charge of a group of people to get a task done, and so the focus is on making sure that everybody does what they need to do, which I might add is a little different than leading, where there's a more of a visionary piece, and it's trying to not only lead people, but help grow and develop them as employees. So just a subtle difference between the two.
Sure. Greg, somebody gave me a definition of a manager, and probably 25, 30 years ago now. And a manager is someone who puts, let me see, how did they go? A manager is someone who puts in something that isn't. That's what it was. Puts in something that isn't. They don't just manage. They're creative, and those things that the employees don't see, the manager sees and moves them in the direction that the company wants.
Another great definition, of course. And I would say, you know, Michael, from my perspective, because part of what I do is I have to fix problems.
Sure.
And the most common call I get is a manager that's struggling or in trouble, or even a CEO or a director. And sometimes when I go in there and they use the management word, what I really realize is it might be what you just said, but what they're still missing some of the pieces, which is, you know, the leadership that I talked about earlier. And as a result of that, they're taking everybody down with them.
And one of the things I really believe, Greg, in my heart of hearts, for everything I've seen over the years also, in and out of businesses, from inside, outside, et cetera, that a manager is not somebody who innately knows how to manage. That's a learned strategy. There's a process to becoming a manager, and if somebody's going to become a manager, they have to know what it is that they have to do to get the job done.
Well, and of course, there's two components to managing. There's getting the task done, as you mentioned, and there's also the people side of it. And if, you know, I guess from my experience, what I've seen is that it's the people side that sometimes is an afterthought when somebody gets promoted or hired. And then the comment is, well, we'll send them to a couple classes, or, maybe their supervisor, you know, we'll help them out at the beginning. But the truth is what usually gets them in trouble is not so much managing the task as managing the people. And that's the part that I think we probably have to give a little bit more attention to.
Haven't we lost touch with that in the last few years? You know, we've got the, you know, the Blackberries and the iPhones and the whatever. And used to be, in the old days, you went to work at 9 o'clock and you left at 5 o'clock with a lunch break and so on and so forth. Now, some of these kids today could be sitting out on the beach with a Blackberry, something that you can fit in your hand and get the entire day done.
Well, not just that. I mean, I've facilitated many meetings with an executive team, and the CEO or the, you know, the CFO, or they're all playing on their cell phones right in the middle of the meeting that are topics that they need to give input to. And in a way, they're kind of role modeling to the rest of the organization, let alone the management team, you know, that they're multitasking right there in a meeting, so they're only partially paying attention.
Oh, sure. And one of the things I've learned over the years, I've done some consulting on and off, and what I would do is I would walk into a business, and whoever the CEO was, COO, whatever the title was at the time, I would ask them to write down what their subordinate, whatever manager it was, whatever title it was, what they were supposed to do, what was their job. And then I would go to that person and I would sit down and say, okay, write down, what is your job? And if you match the two together, Greg, 9 out of 10 times they never matched up. And if you let it trickle all the way down, you see one of the major problems in business is that the left hand truly doesn't know what the right hand is doing. And that's an easy fix.
Well, and where I see that play out the most is right around performance appraisal time. Because all of a sudden, in some cases, you know, the employee evaluates themselves as well, and then they bring their results into their manager and they compare. But in other cases, they're walking in there blindly, not knowing how they're going to be evaluated, and then all of a sudden they're upset because they didn't know that that was an expectation or that was a criteria.
No question. And by the way, going to the book, the Monday at 3 o'clock, you know, there's so many books on management, et cetera, so on and so forth, and there's so many people who say, do it this way, do it that way, do it this way. What I think is brilliant when someone has the concept, they've got it down, and they frame it in a story where instead of telling somebody you're doing something wrong, those people that are reading it can recognize what it is that they're missing or don't know what they're missing. I think it's a much more powerful way to get a point across.
Yeah, and I might add that I wrote this book a little bit different than the traditional business storybook, because if you look at the bookshelves today in the management section, you know, there's a lot of stories. It's becoming kind of a common theme. But the difference is many of those are called fables, and a fable typically is about 140 pages, and it's 5 points, and a story is built around it, which I might add is an effective tool. However, I could either choose to just be yet another fable in the mix of fables, or what I decide to do is take a risk and write a full-fledged novel, 460-page novel that covers really a year in the life of a struggling manager as he has to turn around a very negative situation into a positive situation. And you go through the trials and tribulations, the personal life, the meetings that went astray, to the effective successes. And I wanted people at the end of the book to be able to feel like they just experienced a year in a management position.
And when you do it that way, there's a recognition. And realistically, I think that word recognition is one of the most important words when you're dealing with communication. Because if I don't recognize myself within the context of a story, the context of a statement, for the most part, if it's not about me, I'm not going to listen. It's going to go right over my head. So you have people that are in business that get involved in the story, and they're very much like real-life people in that story. They're not the people in the story that they're reading about. They're reading about themselves.
Yeah, themselves and their experience. And, you know, because I just had the audio book done, I had an actor do it, and he does voices. And he notified me that, by the way, Greg, there's 18 different characters in your book, so he had to come up with 18 different voices. But he did a marvelous job. So, you know, for all your listeners that are not readers, just know that the audiobook is available on the website.
Oh, wonderful. Now, what's the website?
It's Greg Giesen, GIESEN.com.
Okay, GregGiesen.com. Now, the characters that you have within the book, were they based on real-life characters or were they based on imaginary characters?
Well, you know, I mean, I've been in the field for about 25 years as a consultant, and then before that, manager who obviously made many of the mistakes that are in the book. So of the 18 characters, there's one that's named after my mentor in graduate school at Miami of Ohio, and his name was Dr. Mack. And, you know, he was one of those guys, and Michael, you've probably met many people like this, where when you're in his presence, you feel like the most important person in the world. And he had that impact on everybody. And I can tell you, he wasn't the toughest professor, but he's the only one I remember because of how I felt in his presence. And so one of the main characters is Dr. Mack, who's a newspaper columnist, and the other character is Justin, who's the struggling supervisor who nobody's helping him work through these issues because he just got promoted over his peers. And as a result, he actually turns to this newspaper columnist and starts submitting problems through the newspaper, and that's how he actually gets advice. It's through the newspaper. And so of all those characters, you know, he's probably the only one that's real. The rest of them are fiction. But the other sad thing about this is he knew I was writing this book, you know, and he was 86 when it was published, and he passed away the day the book came out.
Oh, but he knew the book was coming out then.
Yeah, he knew the book was coming out, and
yeah, but at least when he went, knew. Yeah, at least he knew. You know, Maya Angelou, the poet, said, "People won't remember what you said, they won't remember what you did, but they will remember how you made them feel." And that's really what's critical within the context of either a verbal presentation or written presentation. It's when I recognize, I probably use that word five times now, when I recognize myself as the reader, as the watcher, listener, whatever, when I recognize myself within the context of it, I'm going to get a feeling, I'm going to get a reaction out of it. And I think that's critically important. So many people say, and it's cliche almost anymore, you know, within a story, there's got to be feelings, there's got to be emotions. But there's a dynamic that occurs within the context of that. And if you intentionally create the dynamic and somebody's on the other side of it listening, then you're going to get everything that you want out of writing. Plus, they'll get what they want out of what they hear and what they see. Now, let's take it to the next step. A book can give you so much. And then there's that point where it stops. So what I've seen you're doing here is you've got the three-day intensive to go beyond where the book was, where people can actually get their hands on to be able to do what you're talking about. And how do we get involved in that, and how does that work?
Well, the three-day intensive is called Leading From Within. It's also on the website, so people can check it out. It does. It takes the book to another level, because what it's really about is what I would call personal retreat, something that, and you don't even have to be in a leadership position to take advantage of this, but where you get an opportunity for 3 days, two nights in a very small support group, because it's limited to 16 people, to really do a lot of internal work, you know, for the things we've been talking about, from what am I passionate about, what's my purpose, how am I showing up in the world, how do I treat people, am I successful, unsuccessful, and we really push them to really get in touch with what we would call their authentic self. And you've heard the term authentic leadership, and it's all kind of one and the same, because here's where it ties in, is because of what I do, and because I go into companies and fix a lot of problems, I see what causes the problem. And a lot of times it's managers or leaders that are inconsistent. And the reason why they're inconsistent is because they attune to what's called reactive management, which is whatever fire's the biggest, they put out, and then they go to the next fire. And there's no continuity between all that. There's no focus. Nobody knows what they stand for. They don't know. All they're seeing is this inconsistency, and that breeds distrust. So this leadership program is really a way for people to get back in touch with their core values, their purpose, what matters to them. And then wherever they go after the retreat, whether it's the workplace or at home with the family, there's a centeredness, there's a connectedness to the ground, and there's a foundation that they didn't have before. And what I've discovered is that a lot of people put that on the back burner doing it because it sounds nice, but when it push comes to shove, everything else is a higher priority, and they never take care of themselves.
No, but let's add something to that. I can experience what something else that will happen in the workshop. If they can't grasp what their own authenticity is when they go in, at least you give them a model to look for. If I, and then if they can, they can realize what it is. It's not what they're missing. It's what they don't know that they're missing. And I think that in and of itself, there's a power there. And as they leave the workshop, now all of a sudden they gain something. It was always there, but they didn't recognize it was there. I think that in and of itself is important.
Yeah, and not only that, one way we do to make that happen is it's an indoor-outdoor program. So there's a lot of outdoor, whether it's activities, a vision quest hike, in the room, the classroom, it's we're all in a circle in a chair. That's actually the classroom. We're in the mountains, or we did it in San Diego a few months ago, and we were on the beach. So it's in a beautiful place where you can't be disturbed, and you really there's nowhere to go but to look in. And you're right. That kind of insight happens whether they come with it or not. And then when they leave, the best part is the reason why we have it only 16 people is to represent what's called your circle of friends or your circle of influence and how powerful people felt in that group. And then the task is to make sure you create that outside of the workshop so that you feel that same way and get that same kind of support.
Wonderful. We're just about out of time. Do you have a website again that we can find you at?
Yes, it's Greg, G-R-E-G, Giesen, G-I-E-S-E-N.com. And all the information is on there about the books, the workshop, my radio show, everything is right there for you.
Oh, by the way, how do we find you on your radio show?
Well, you can go right to my website and click Listen Live right from the website.
Wonderful. Okay, and what time is it, the show?
It 3 o'clock on Mondays, of course.
Love
That's
every second.
Time.
Why not? Hey, Greg, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. Shane Hoffman with us. He's a student at Bloomsburg University. He became interested in Norman Gundrum's story after learning about his grandmother, who was a librarian at Norman's school, had been corresponding with him for years. When Shane visited Norman in prison, he realized that Norman's story needed to be shared. Shane's book is entitled, Are You Dead Yet? Shane, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi, and thank you so much for being here. What was the impetus, Shane? What caused you to, number one, create that title? What was it about your experience of that allowed you to put that title together?
Well, it's been rumored many times that during the killing that Norman repeated several times, are you dead yet? And whether or not that's true or not, no one knows but him, Ricky, and unfortunately the murder victim. So that's what led me to title the book, Are You Dead Yet?
Now, by the way, okay, we're dealing with Norman, who murdered his friend when he was just 15 after dealing with bullying and abuse and so on and so forth. The key is with abuse. Can abuse cause, I mean, obviously it can, but can abuse really be that determining factor that will cause somebody to go beyond everything and kill someone?
Well, I believe, you know, when you take an individual and from early on you abuse them and sexually abuse the person, and they don't reach out for help, and nobody's trying to help the kid, and that's all you know, and you keep all that inside of you, eventually you're going to blow up. And unfortunately, that's what happened with Gundrum. I know in many cases it doesn't happen this severe, but in this poor kid's situation, he was tormented his entire life, and in a moment of desperation, lashed out, and it unfortunately cost someone their life, and it cost him the rest of his life behind bars.
Now, by the way, what kind of a kid was he, or is he? Well, I have to say was he, because he's not, you know, being behind bars, his life, quote-unquote, is over with. But what kind of a kid was he? Was he a depressive kid? Was he an outgoing kid? What was there in that person?
Gundrum was the type of kid that sat in the back of the classroom not wanting the teacher to call upon him. You know, he was very shy. You know, and his personality, he always wanted to be accepted. You know, that's his big thing. He wanted his peers, teachers, parents, whoever, to accept him. He always wanted to be a part of the in crowd. And he was always that kid that kind of stood off by himself.
And if we were to sit down with him today, actually just sit down with Norman today and say to him, what advice could you give another kid? What would you tell them to do to be able to avoid what happened to him?
With talking to Norman in prison, it came pretty clear his main message was reach out, find somebody, whether it's a principal, a teacher, whoever it is, you know, reach out, find someone who cares, tell an adult, let somebody know that you're being hurt and that you can't take it anymore, you know? And that's his biggest thing was, you know, not reaching out. And I believe that if he would have done that and there would have been someone there for him, this never would have happened.
Now, by the way, when you take a kid like this, and obviously you just said the key, and the key is the ability to express it, to be understood. Does Norman's parents, did anybody listen to this youngster?
No, and that's one thing that I find hard to believe. A 9-year-old kid who ventures out and gets a job working for a professor who later on sexually abuses him and consistently having, you know, health problems in school and having nurses call home, where was the person in his life that did not see this happening? And that's what disturbs me more than anything, is the fact that where was that adult? Where was someone to help this kid out when he needed it the most?
Are we so self-centered that we just don't see these things? You know, the Normans of the world are standing in front of us, and we're so blind that they don't exist?
I don't think it's so much that we're blind and they don't exist. I think people are so focused on their own issues, their own problems, no matter how big or small they are, that a lot of times when things are going down like that, something's going wrong, you see someone like that, I think we're just too wrapped up in our own lives to step outside of ourselves for a moment and look at a poor individual who's, you know, crying out for help. And that's not right, and it's not wrong. It's just unfortunately how we live our lives.
You know, we keep hearing, and I come from an age that, Shane, that we didn't have counselors, we didn't have this, we didn't have that. It was a whole different world back then. But in this world today, where if somebody looks like they have a problem, there's usually a counselor right there on the spot. Where were those people? Where were those trained professionals, even from the schools, that are supposed to see this?
In my opinion, I think the people in that school system were too focused on being friends with kids in that school who were popular, who were the athletes. I think a lot of them, their own agenda was so far out in left field that it's sickening. They see it, and they knew it. But it's not until something terrible happens that somebody wants to step forth and say, hey, you know what, maybe we should have helped this kid out. Maybe we should have done something. Instead of when you see this happening, them turning their heads. They were qualified people. And it's just pure ignorance, in my opinion.
Let me tell you, Shane, what I see, and I've listened very closely to many, many different instances about bullying and people who have written books and their essays and so on and so forth. That my opinion of this today, years ago, if a bully chased you down, they beat you up and it was the end of it. And, you know, you stayed on the other side of the schoolyard and it was over with. What I believe today, bullying in and of itself has become a culture. There's a method behind the bullying. There's an intention, an intensiveness that wasn't there years ago. You know, you got these people who do cyberbullying, and you got people who kill themselves because of the cyberbullying, and you got the bully standing across the street or close to the graveyards when the memorials are going on, and still calling names and so on and so forth. It's almost like a sickness. Where does this come from? Where does this bullying? I don't even know what to call it anymore, Shane. But where does this bullying come from? It's not just somebody's beating somebody up. It's much more intense than that now.
Yeah, that's something you were saying about the cyberbullying. To me, as we move further and further along in technology, it's so easy for someone to sit behind a computer and pick on someone and remain anonymous. As drugs and our, you know, we have teenage kids, you know, hooked on heroin, hooked on drugs that are killing them. As drugs and technology get more and more advanced, I think we really move away from a civil society. You know, we're limiting the contact, eye-to-eye contact with people. Everybody's text messaging these days. You know, everybody is Facebooking someone these days. And with that becomes, you know, people kind of hide within themselves, in my opinion. And that's where I think the bullying really starts to increase. Because, like you said, you know, the age where you come from, yeah, someone picked on you, you fought, and, you know, a day later you became best friends.
That's it.
Unfortunately, we just don't live in that world anymore, and it's sad, and I don't see it getting any better.
No, and neither do I. And I think a lot of what goes on today has to do with the ability to be accepted. If I have to repeat that 10,000 times a day, I would love to get that message across. It's getting accepted. So if I'm going to bully and I've got something in common with another bully and we've got a kid that we can pick on, now we have acceptance. We have identity. Quote, unquote, we're bullies and we'll die for it. And I really believe that the majority of this starts within the family. It's the parents not recognizing what's going on with their kids or not giving those kids that connection that the kids need to be able to get some kind of a strength in life and identify with something, the family.
Yeah, and that's the thing you're saying. You know, everybody today wants to be like the next person. Everybody wants to be accepted. I don't know whatever happened to people wanting to be themselves, being unique, you know. And
sure.
And it's a sad thing, you know. One of the most famous musicians, John Lennon, once said, he goes, you know, I'm a freak. I always will be. I just guess I'm one of those people. You know, and that's a big statement coming from someone with such popularity and fame. You know, where does that exist today? Everybody needs to fit in. Everybody has to be in that in-group. In my opinion, the people, you know, once you are in that group, all you're doing is consistently competing with the person next to you, and it's not, once you get there, it's not as glamorous as you thought it would be.
Absolutely, and there are people who are not accepted at home, they're not accepted in school, so what do? They drop out of school and they join gangs. And this in and of itself is more acceptance and it's more identity. That's really why I think where the problem is, and to begin with Norman. I mean, Norman's done. It's over with. There's no going back and fixing this with Norman. But if there's any way that Norman can get if they can get this word out about what can happen to you if you take this to the extreme, because the two of the kids died, the guy that Norman killed, but Norman's life was over the minute that he caused that other person's death. Norman's
Absolutely.
Got the worst end of this.
Yeah, and that's a sad fact, you know. You mentioned, you know, Norman's case is said and done. And the only thing we can do now is hopefully what I want to do is reach out to people. Because I know this is happening at the moment as we speak, somewhere in the world, all around. I want someone to sit down and read it and take it from a perspective of don't let this happen to me. You know, I want people when they read that to say that to themselves, you know, do differently, you know.
No question about it. But and I don't believe in sensitivity classes. I'm too old school for any of that stuff. But there's got to be something that alerts people to, or something that can teach people, and I mean teach people, to be able to recognize the symptoms of that person that's being bullied, to recognize if there's a little bit of a change, if there's something different in the behavior, if there's a little more being quiet, you know, what's going on, to sit down and to be able to pull it out and talk about it, because if this could have happened in Norman's life, both of those things wouldn't have happened. The kid that he killed wouldn't have been dead, and Norman wouldn't be in jail.
Yeah, and that's something, you know, I completely agree with you. Classes, you know, teach people how to handle this. What are the signs, and deal with it. It seems like any more today, especially a kid, has every time a kid has a complaint or gets upset, automatically everybody thinks there's a disorder. You go to the doctor, they prescribe you drugs. You go back, they prescribe you more drugs, and they want to put you in certain counselors, and that's all, and all they want to do is examine if you're acting different. You know, I don't think that's helping anybody. I think, you sit a kid down, you sit a person down, and you show a genuine understanding and care for them, and show them how to handle themselves, how to get through situations like that.
Oh, no question about it. And that, you just said it. Show them how to get through situations like that. Just because we're born and we're human beings and we may learn how to read and write and do math does not mean we know how to navigate life. There's got to be a compass in there, and we've got to stay on course. But you don't just automatically stay on course. You get knocked down, you get up, you get knocked down, you get up. But there's always got to be somebody there to say, well, let's try it this way. And that's how you stay focused on what you want out of life. But being attacked by a bully, who gets trained for that? Nobody. I mean emotionally. I don't mean physically. Emotionally.
Yeah, and I mean you hit the nail on the head. I mean, I guess you can train someone physically, but emotionally, it's tough. That's where you bring in people, you know, who have been through some emotional and mental roller coasters through their life, and have managed to come out of that. Someone who has experience through that you bring in.
Absolutely. It's the been there, the done that, and I think the prison system would open it up, and let people come in and talk to Norman and actually let him do some workshops. I think he could probably save some lives out there. Shane, you should work on that.
That's something I'll definitely consider.
Yeah, what the heck. All right, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you and also buy the book?
I do not have a website, but the best place to find the book is Amazon.com.
Wonderful. And by the way, you should get a website.
I think I will now.
Yeah. Okay. You want that exposure. You've got a powerful message. And the only way they're going to get it is if they know where to go to find it.
Absolutely.
Okay. Hey, Shane Hoffman, thank you so much for joining us. Good job.
Thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Okay. Take care.
Yep.
Good night.
Bye.
Gone away, you're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so good. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you need me, you know we now some of these days.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on In Dresser After Dark. Richard Christie with us, retired from his Hollywood-based film editing supply company. Since its inception, he supplied film editing equipment to major studios, labs, producers, directors, including legendary film producer David Wolper, director Francis Ford Coppola for Apocalypse Now and The Godfather. As We Remember It, that's the book, over 60 years of friendship, and a collection of stories from each person in the group that he grew up with. And let's say, Richard, hi, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Michael. Thank you.
Oh, and thank you so much. I'm looking at this. Richard Christie and his eight friends met back in the 40s at a Los Angeles YMCA, and they called themselves the Ambassadors. My friends grew up in Los Angeles in the 50s, and we called ourselves the Tartars.
The Tartars.
Way back. I look at this, and I keep seeing it. One of them just recently passed away, and you know the group still keeps in touch with. We still keep in touch with ourselves, many years. It's a bond that's always going to be there, and it doesn't matter where you go or how many miles you go away. There's that something because they were part of your life that caused you to be who you are today.
That is very true. Very true.
Yeah. Now, what was it that stimulated to, you to put this to pen?
We would always get together, and we'd kind of mull over the same stories over and over. And so in July of last year, I sent out a letter and asking people to send me in the stories that we have talked about. And a few of them came in, and then we did a video 2.5 hours in Glendale, and we had seven of us plus the YMCA leader, and he was 92 years old at the time. And he came down and told stories. Then we compiled those along with 2 hours of video that we did in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
And anyway, I get together with these men probably on a monthly basis. Last weekend, I saw three of them.
Yeah, by the way, they're never going to be men. They're always going to be the boys.
That is true. That is true.
Now, by the way, what city did you grow up in?
Los Angeles.
Oh, L.A. proper?
L.A. proper. Went to Dorsey High School, which is inner city, I think, now.
I was brought up in probably the most famous city in Southern California. You ready for this?
Yes, I'm
It's only famous because everybody who was running the city, the police chief and the mayor, and everybody's in jail right now. I was brought up in Bell.
Yes, we hear about Bell all the time.
Yeah, no, Bell, Southgate, Huntington Park, that's the area that I grew up in. And in those days, it's very hard, Richard, it's very hard to let people know what it was like growing up in those days. It was the Fonz, it was John Wayne, it was all of those things that people would not really get a grasp on today. And it was very much like Ozzy and Harriet, because that's what life was really like.
Basically, that's very true. It was a good time to live. We had great times. We had great bonding with your friends and things. A lot of sports, trips with the YMCA. Till we got into high school, and then we kind of branched out a little farther than the Y was liking us to take.
See, I remember way back when. That I remember that the Alcazar Theater, that was the local show in town, and we were always there on Friday nights and whatever. I remember the way things worked. I remember I got into a fight in the show, and the next thing I know, I've got somebody at the back of my shirt, and it was a cop, and he pulled me out, and he took me across the street where the police station was, picked up the phone, called my mother. He said, "Your son's in trouble. I'm sending him home," and that was the end of it. But that was those days.
Yeah, that's true. There weren't the drugs were not available, or they weren't in our area.
No.
One of the guys, Is there something cutting in?
No, that was probably a call from the White House making sure we were being nice on the air.
I see.
It's okay. It's okay. Yeah.
One of the trips that we took to Catalina ended up partially in that, and one of the young men was put into a cell, and they didn't even lock the door. And he became friends with everybody there. And matter of fact, Jack's on the front cover. And so
I see it. Yeah. But it was great. It was one of the, it was something that it was so innocent that it wasn't, you're right. You didn't have the drugs. Now, I graduated probably about 10 years after you. Your guys were there in the 40s. Mine were there in the 50s. I got out of high school in 1960. And 58 and 59, Richard, that's about when marijuana just became kind of sort of acceptable. We didn't live in the world of drugs that the kids live in today.
No, we did not. I do not recall any of our people using drugs. Some of the people outside of the area was involved in it, but not a...
Yeah. Not major like it is today. Absolutely not. And better yet, how about this? Do you remember any of the girls getting pregnant in high school?
No.
No.
I shouldn't say no. I think one girl did, and I can't even remember her name.
No, I'm sitting here smiling because when I think about it, there was one girl when I went to school, too, and they whisk her out of the city real quick. But it was different. And in those days, the cowboy didn't kiss the girl at the end of the movie, kissed the horse. We didn't have garbage on you. Yeah. And by the way, as long as those memories live, you know what you've done. You've taken a piece of history and you've created in such a way that many people are going to remember this that are obviously of a certain age. And I think it's a very special book. And what went into it is very special. Those are things that we'll never be able to capture again. We live in a different world. We live in a different culture.
That is very true. Very true.
Well, then, how many of the guys are left?
We have 9 of us left. We had 10 when I started the book. And one of the gentlemen that lives in Nevada passed on. He's was an American Airline pilot and also a pilot in the Navy of flew fighters over Vietnam. All of us went into one branch of the service or the other. 7 of us went in the Marine Corps.
Did you go in the Marine Corps?
The Army. Yes.
Semper Fi.
Hey, Semper Fi, sir.
Yeah, you bet. MCRD, 1960.
When?
MCRD, 1960.
1960, yeah. We went in 55.
Yeah, and, that's about, yeah.
And it all started with a strange story. Also, Jack, the guy on the front cover, was the first one to go into the Marine Corps. He mailed home to his mother a menu from Christmas dinner. Mm. Well, she showed it to another one of our friends, Giz, and... he showed it to the rest of the guys. He said, this looks like summer camp. You know, we ought to go. So 4 of them left high school a little early to get in under the GI Bill. And then I went in May, and then another friend, Tiger, went in June. Yeah. And we were in between Vietnam and Korea. So we did not see any combat.
Yeah, same here. No, exactly. And I remember when I went through boot summer camp. Yeah, sure. I finished my last year in high school. I ran track and I played football, and then I went to boot camp. I graduated June 18th. On the 21st, I was standing tall in San Diego, and I didn't know what being in condition was till I went through boot camp.
That is true.
Yeah. Well, did you go through San Diego or Parris Island?
San Diego, yeah.
Okay, and ITR at Pendleton?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, same.
And then I spent a year at Camp Pendleton, then 2 years in Yokosuka, Japan, Marine Barracks over there.
There's just a whole different world and a whole different way of looking at things. You know, the other thing, if you really want to go back from memory, remember the Long Beach Pike?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. See, I think it's gone now. Yeah, that was part of growing up in those days.
It was. One of the ladies, I belong to the Kiwanis here in Southern California, she read my book, and when she was growing up, she used to go to the restaurant my dad owned that I worked in the 50s, early 50s, and 55 I quit and went in the Marine Corps.
What a world, huh? You know, and it, when you said, you know, the real happy days, it was like happy days. I mean, and one of the things, Dick, that we experienced was basically this. It was a very innocent time to grow up. It was after the Second World War. Moms in the late 40s and in the 50s decided to stay home and take care of families because they lost so many kids during the war, that it was just a completely different world that we lived in. It was different as far as family was concerned, and what was good and bad was completely different in those days too.
That is very, very true.
Yeah.
We had good times. Go ahead.
No, absolutely. Okay. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Stepping on your lines.
No, go
ahead.
We
had good times. Nothing really was too far out of line. I mean, we got into mischief, but nothing like's happening today. And it was a good time to grow up. And I have some dear friends that we still see each other. I saw three of them Sunday. There was a ladies group, and they put a party on for pregnant Marines out of Camp Pendleton. And they had nine of them there. And out of the nine, three were women Marines. And there was a Corps woman, and the others were wives of Marines that were stationed there. And it was quite a party.
No, I bet it was. And I really think when you go back and you look and you can write the books about it, you can make movies about it, and you can play with it. But it's a very special gift that you have, that I have, that some of us are still around, that we have. And it's not a gift you can give to anybody anymore. It was just that way of life that you were brought up with. Mom and dad were mom and dad. You didn't mess with them. And if you got your rear end whacked in school by the vice principal or the coach, too bad. You didn't do it again. And it was over with. And we played sports, and everybody didn't win. Just the best of them won. And you try to be better. And it was that kind of a world.
That is very true. Very true.
Yeah. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, it's called InSync, InSync, Pubs, PUBS, .com.
And, wonderful.
It was
Go ahead.
A paper that I put out for the motion picture industry.
Wonderful. Hey, Dick Christie, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, I sure appreciate it. Thank you very much, Michael.
My pleasure. Take care. Good night.
I'm the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore from now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy.
All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, yeah, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Off comes the makeup. Off comes the clown's disguise. The curtain's falling. The music softly dies. But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say in this biz, that's all there is, there isn't any more.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
We've shared a moment. And as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do,